Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading some interesting articles from the October 2021 issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Lost and Found by Hunter Hawk. I was loading up the car for a July 4th family get-together when I saw her running up and down the middle lane of a busy street, skinny, panting, and panicked with a filthy collar and chain link hanging from her neck. This stranger was not coping well with independence. While I'm not too often a tentative dude, I never hesitate for a second to give aid to an innocent creature in need. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. As soon as I felt she was safe from traffic, I squatted down and called her over. 10 minutes later, she was in my backyard eating canned food I'd brought out, drinking fresh water and thanking me with two of the most gorgeous canine eyes I've ever seen. Yet another poor creature who bolted when the fireworks exploded. I'll never know, but my surprise visitor and I are now on our 20th day of doggy rehab together. At 28 pounds, she responds to Ella and is resting comfortably in my living room, wearing a cone of shame following her spaying surgery. Tagless when I found her, or when she found me, she's now registered, chipped, vet checked, and building her strength for several upcoming rounds of heartworm treatments. And she's trying so hard to win the affection of my admittedly irascible male terrier, who ain't quite as charitable as I am in these types of situations. I want to get Ella in shape to be a healthy, thriving member of my family, or the pretty-eyed constant in someone else's loving home. Either way, she's a damn fine dog. Follows you everywhere you go, lies at your feet, watches over you when you nap in a non-creepy way, and bounds around outside with a newfound vigor. She trains amazingly well. I could see her fitting right in on a farm or a ranch and taking on her share of good, honest work. To think someone didn't see that in her, kept her chained up on her own, or even dumped her, it confounds me. As special and magical as Ella is, there's sadly nothing singular about her story. There are millions of similar tales of lost, abused, and neglected would-be best friends, and so many without a happy ending. We often look to heroic organizations such as Best Friends Animal Society, the American Humane Society, and countless local no-kill shelters like the one in my small Texas town that checked Ella for a chip and offered me a spaying voucher. But it's abundantly clear that we should do more on an individual level. Anyone at CNI will tell you the same. We're a team made up of passionate animal lovers and rescuers. Whether these furry friends show up at our ranches or on busy streets outside our houses, we're always willing to give them some shelter and care and the chance at a good life. It's all about love and companionship. This is where you come in. Do you live with the best furry friend and co-worker in the West? Send a photo to letters@cowboysindians.com and tell us why your canine companion is key in your home and family. We'll be featuring stories about the joy and meaning dogs and other animals bring to our lives in upcoming issues of CNI. In the meantime, keep your eyes peeled and hearts open for the friendless and the needy. Cody Johnson. The rising country superstar talks about his journey so far, from rodeo to radio, by Allison Bonaguro. This is how you know Cody Johnson is part cowboy and part country singer. When Cowboys and Indians visited earlier this year with the 34-year-old country star on his tour bus in San Antonio, he was getting ready to take the stage for a concert at Cowboys Dance Hall. But he was also preparing to train for team roping in the Bob Feist Invitational in Guthrie, Oklahoma. I always had my head set that if you don't ride, you ain't no cowboy, Johnson said. He started as a little boy growing up with the Lone Ranger and John Wayne as role models. And although his path to country music wasn't a direct one, it's been plenty fruitful. For the last 14 years, Johnson has been a fixture on the touring circuit, sold 260,000 albums, and played Rodeo Houston in 2019 to a sold-out crowd of over 75,000. Read on for our conversation with the in-demand vocalist who, at the time of the visit, was also gearing up for this year's release of both a new double album and a biographical documentary. You weren't born in the rodeo life like so many bull riders are, so what originally inspired you to make a run at it? I watched The Lone Ranger and all the time when I was a kid. It was my favorite, those old black and white shows with Clayton Moore, and I would watch a lot of Lonesome Dove and a lot of John Wayne movies. I've pretty much seen every John Wayne movie. I was just drawn to his characters. My dad rode horses for the state of Texas, but he's not a cowboy. He doesn't go out and rope and ride. I think you have to feel there's something inside of you. So it was pure gut instinct to be a cowboy? Well, the bull riding thing was actually an accident. My friend was a welder, and he asked me to come check out a bull riding pen he'd just welded. I was watching these guys ride, and they were like, "If you ain't a bull rider, you need to get out of the chute and go sit in the stands." I was like, "I'm not scared to get on one." So I borrowed a rope, some gloves and spurs, got on one, and got my ass kicked. I was only on for about a half second before I got the crap stomped out of me. "Then why did you go back?" I kept going back, again and again and again. I didn't have the talent most bull riders had, because they start on calves and steers and learn the basics. But I basically just jumped into the water and prayed not to drown. Eventually, I would ride one here and there, and it gave me that little glimpse of hope that I could do it. So how old were you when you first rode a bull? And then when you rode your last bull? I was 15 when I started, and I rode until I was 19. I truly believed that I was going to get it, and sometimes I did. I've got recordings of me riding, and I wasn't bad, but it's like giving a drug addict just enough to be addicted. You're always chasing that. And I always thought I was going to be a world champion in the Professional Rodeo Cowboys Association. But that takes years of preparation that I did not have, maturity that I did not have, and an athletic ability that I did not have. I'm assuming this was right around the same time that you worked in the Texas prison system. What was that like? I was around the prison system my entire life because my dad worked there for 32 years. I started there when I was 18 just because that's what my dad did. I worked in intake first, and it was an eye-opening experience. Then I moved to the Goree unit, a sexual offender treatment program unit, and then I worked in maximum security. And then I rode horses as a field boss. Eventually, the warden sat me down and said, "You need to quit this job and go play music. You're already playing so many gigs that you're having trouble showing up for work on time. You just need to go. Prison will always be here." That sounds risky, to give up a steady paycheck, benefits, insurance, and a pension. What did your better half, Brandy, think? Do you know what she did? When I quit the prison, she quit going to college and took two jobs so that we could go out and play music. And we didn't make any money for the first 2 years. That woman is down. That woman is down for the cause. Are you ever going to write songs about doing time in prison? It's been a while since country music's had a solid prison song. I think that the prison stuff will probably show up in my writing later on. It's much like how the bull riding stuff happened, and then years later, after I'd let it go, I addressed it in the song Dear Rodeo. But I've never addressed the dark side of what happens in prison, just because I think I would have to address things within myself. But it will happen. Songwriting's only done that for me. When did you have your epiphany about it was time to hang up your ropes and spurs? Well, first I tried to go to college, and I had a part-time job shaping cowboy hats in Huntsville at Baskin's. So I was working, plus playing music on the side and going to college on the side. I even skipped my first English final to go play a gig. So I knew college was out. I just wasn't college material. And at the same time, I was trying to hit some of the minor league rodeos. I would buck off. I'd go to practice again. I'd ride more, and then it would just be so frustrating because I never could make it happen when it needed to happen. I just finally said, this is not working out. In a way, you make it sound like the rodeo took you for a ride. There's a line in Dear Rodeo that says, I'm jaded, I hate it. Does that sum up your real life feelings about giving up the bull riding dream? That was a pretty dark period for me because I just felt like a loser. I mean, seriously, it's a failure that set in so hard that I became a detriment to myself. And at 19 years old, I wanted to forget about it and party and play music. And that was like, okay, this music thing could work. I firmly believe that was my path. I had to get my hopes up and fail, and God allowed me to fail. If I hadn't lived all that, I would never have been able to move on and to write songs like Dear Rodeo. I'll take that any day of the week. Back then, I felt like the bull riding was what was going to make me a cowboy. But bull riding has nothing to do with being a cowboy. It's your heart. It's your mentality. It's your moral code. It's in your standards for what you will and will not put up with. It's knowing that you can lend a helping hand to anybody, but if you're the one down in the dirt, you have to pick yourself up and dust yourself off and go back to work. That's what cowboy means to me. And that's what Dear Rodeo is all about. Did you realize when you wrote the one about how powerful it would be for anyone, not necessarily just bull riders? It wasn't until after Dan Couch and I wrote it that I started to understand what we had done. It gave me closure. That song helped me let go. And then it helped me to play it with the perspective of helping other people. If you fall down on the ground, do you think, well, I'm already down here, so I should just stay here? Or do you think, I got to get back up and try again? You make it sound easy, as if sometimes the songs write themselves. But early on, when you started booking more and more gigs, were you just out there playing country cover songs? No, I was playing the songs I'd written while I was on the road rodeoing. So from the very beginning, my music was based around the rodeo. My first album that I made by myself a year after I graduated high school, Rodeo Blues, in 2006, was all about that cowboy life. I'd had people tell me that country music had to be relatable, so I worried that people wouldn't relate to my rodeoed songs. But they did then, and they do now. And I cannot stand songs about pickup trucks and short skirts. It's demeaning to women. I have two daughters, and if they wanted to sing a song like that to my daughters, I would be pissed, because those songs are not respectful. After writing from your experiences, you finally got a songwriting deal in which you found some new pressures to produce new stuff. I did. When I signed my deal, I had to write 12 songs a year, but I wrote more like 30. All I would do was go on the road, fly to Nashville, and write, write, write. Go on the road, fly to Nashville, and write, write, write. Again and again. After that, I felt like I had squeezed the sponge as much as I could. That was when I started hearing about great songwriters like Travis Meadows, Tony Lane, Jeffrey Steele, Terry McBride, and I could name you maybe 40 more who couldn't get their songs out because they were too country for country music. So I said, send us the songs that you can't get out. The amount of songs and the quality of the songs was incredible. And what it did for me, it opened up the right brain versus the left brain, because then when I was listening to these songs, I'd be thinking, the demo sounds hip-hop-ish, but could I take that song and make it me? What does it feel like to walk out on stage and see tens of thousands of fans anxiously awaiting your visit? There's a part in Lonesome Dove when the storm is blowing in, and Gus looks at Woodrow and says something like, well, Woodrow, I guess it's time to figure out whether we was meant to be cowboys or not. And he rides off. That's how it feels. The first time I stepped on a big stage, I looked around and thought, this is right where I belong. Just zero nerves. It's stupid how at home I feel up there, but still, every single night, it's very humbling. I am very much addicted to that. I feel like what I do brings positivity and happiness and joy. City Slickers at 30. We celebrate the Western comedy classic that revealed the secret of life and introduced the scariest trail boss in the West and an endearing calf named Norman. When Billy Crystal turned 40, he wasn't happy about it. I was gripped by a very cloudy mood, he wrote in his 2013 memoir, Still Fuddleman. So he did what comedians do when faced with anxiety. He set out to find the humor beneath the heartache. First would come his hilarious star turn as what the Los Angeles Times called a reluctantly romantic leading man in 1989's When Harry Met Sally. Then he hit on a winning idea for what would become another iconic role. City Slickers, he scribbled. Three friends go on a fantasy cattle drive, a metaphor for what was missing in their lives. My character, like me, in his 40s, midlife crisis. Crystal brought the idea to his friend Rob Reiner, who had asked him to join him at Castle Rock Entertainment and had directed him in When Harry Met Sally. In 1991, City Slickers would become another huge hit for Castle Rock, grossing $180 million on a $26 million budget. Crystal played Mitch, a corporate drone dissatisfied with his life, who travels to New Mexico to experience the cowboy way with his best friends Phil, Daniel Stern, and Ed, Bruno Kirby. In casting the pivotal role of Curly, the formidable trail boss, Crystal recalled the first movie he ever saw, Shane. Jack Palance, who played Jack Wilson, the bad guy who gets it in the end, loomed large in the film, especially in the climatic scene. Shane, Alan Ladd, calls Wilson a low-down Yankee liar. Wilson coolly responds, "Prove it." And six shooters are drawn. Jack Palance was our only choice, Crystal wrote. I never forgot how scary he was. City Slickers would produce its own share of memorable lines. Go and find your smile. Do you know what the secret of life is? Out there are all the answers. Like many of the best comedies, City Slickers had more to offer than laughs. The film takes its time getting to know the trio of friends before the story shifts to the cattle drive, so the audience is more invested in their adventures. And when Mitch and Curly head out alone to round up strays and to help birth Norman, the calf, their conversation engenders wistful thoughts of sadness and joy, often in the same instant. Such moments resonated with critics and audiences alike and resulted in a Best Supporting Actor Academy Award nomination for Palance, at a time when comedies were rarely recognized in the major categories. Crystal was hosting the Oscar telecast that year, and Palance won in the first presentation of the night. he delivered a memorable speech about the industry's hesitancy to hire older actors, a mistake he put the lie to by dropping to the floor and doing a series of one-armed push-ups on stage. Crystal milked that moment for the rest of the show with more references to the 73-year-old Palance's machismo. Jack Palance just bungee jumped off the Hollywood sign. 30 years later, the film continues to draw real city slickers west to test their cowboy skills and generate viewer discussions about the best and worst days of their lives. It also created friendships among its cast that would last a lifetime. Billy Crystal delivered the eulogy at Jack's memorial service, recalls Jack Palance's ex-wife Elaine. At one point, he said, when Jack gets to heaven, God will walk up and say, "Hi, Jack, I'm God." And Jack will say, "Prove it." City Slickers was a family affair for Palance. Elaine joined him on the set for his 2 weeks in New Mexico, and his daughter Holly sat next to him when he won the Oscar. They shared their memories with CNI. Elaine. When Jack got the script in the mail, he said, "I don't want to do another Western," so he didn't read it. I went upstairs, read the script, and came down and said, "Jack, you'll be doing this movie." Holly. I loved it. I thought my father was fantastic. Sometimes there are moments in an actor's performance when you see their whole career come together, and I thought those moments were all there in Curly. Elaine. I don't know how sincere he was about not doing Westerns, but Jack was 72 when he made this movie. He didn't ride very often, and when he did, he could tell the next day. But we went to New Mexico and had a blast. Holly. His physicality really worked in that part. He walked slow, and there was a kind of grace in his stride. I remember an article that described him as a tiger on a frayed leash. I just loved that. Elaine. Let me assure you, Jack could be very intimidating in real life. Billy and Bruno Kirby were not very tall, and I think at first Jack did intimidate them. Holly. The combination of Billy and my dad was magical. They really liked each other. When Curly talks about the secret of life being that one thing and puts one finger up, and Billy says, "Your finger?" I think that's why we remember it so fondly. It was philosophical. It had heart. Elaine. My favorite scene was when Billy had to birth the calf. I thought it was brilliant the way they did it. Holly. We had a cattle ranch, Holly Brook, named for me and my sister Brooke. My dad loved being on that ranch. Just as in the movie, there are cows that don't survive giving birth, and we had one stray calf named Vaca that he kept as a pet, like Norman. He would come into the house when he was small, and when he grew up, he couldn't fit through the door. My dad loved that calf. Elaine. Who doesn't want to be a cowboy? Dude Ranches really enjoyed a resurgence after the film because everybody wanted to go out and do what those guys did. Holly. I went with him to the Oscars. He was so nervous because he already won the Golden Globe and thought that he could win. When his category came up, I heard him whisper, "I'm getting out of here. If I win, would you mind going up and getting it for me?" That would have been my worst nightmare. But a moment later, he won, and he ran up to get it. Then I see him doing these push-ups. Elaine. After the Oscars, everywhere we went, even as far away as Denmark, as soon as someone saw him, they would shout, "Jack," and start doing one-armed push-ups.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading articles from True West Magazine, September 2021 edition. Tombstone's Naked Chef by Sherry Monahan. Tombstone, Arizona is known for many things, but I bet you've never heard of its Naked Chef, Oh, yes. Isaac Little Jakey Jacobs was quite a character, so it's fitting he lived in a town that was full of them. Jacobs was a 27-year-old Russian whose catering skills were well known, and in 1880, he ran a lunch counter at the Oriental Saloon, where he served fresh fish, oysters, lobster, crab, and shrimp from San Francisco. No, he didn't cook naked, but he did race that way. It was about 3:30 p.m. on November 11th, 1880, when Jacobs and tobacconist Isaac Levy met on the Dragoon Road to compete against each other in a 50-yard foot race in the Buff. The Tombstone Epitaph reported that the race was for a French dinner for five at Jakey's, though it is intimated that a large bundle changed hands besides. At the time stated, both appeared and presented a very gallant appearance. Stripped as they were to the Buff, Jakey's costume consisting of a diamond pin and a pair of running shoes. Jacobs was leading at the 30-foot mark until he stopped to pick up a 4-bit coin on the street that someone had intentionally left. Despite the distraction, Jacobs claimed he lost because he wasn't in shape, but demanded a second chance. A year later, when the Maison Dorée opened in the Cosmopolitan Hotel, George Marx hired Jacobs to run the kitchen. One of his many duties was to procure meat, so he placed an ad in the local paper soliciting wild game. Jacobs' appeal to the public worked, and shortly thereafter, he was preparing delicious meals for his patrons, and did so until December 1881. In January 1882, he opened his own restaurant on 4th Street, where he once served George Hearst, the father of William Randolph Hearst, when he toured the mines in southern Arizona. Jacobs also created a culinary triumph after one of Tombstone's baseball games in 1882. The dignitaries in attendance were invited to the Cochise Club and then dined at Jakey's, where they enjoyed fresh fish from Guaymas, Sonora, Mexico, oysters from the east, and wild game from the nearby mountains. In May 1882, Jacobs opened the Grand Restaurant, housed in the new front addition of the Grand Hotel at 422 Allen. It was originally designed as a store, so it was spacious and had high ceilings that made it feel bright and airy. It contained 6 elegant private dining rooms, a public dining hall with 4 tables, and a family dining hall. The Tombstone Epitaph wrote, "The fact that Jacobs has taken the dining room to the Grand is an assurance to the public that Tombstone is fast to have an eating house worthy of the town. Jakey is the boss caterer of Arizona. Don't you forget it." Jacobs created a window display sporting a fountain filled with rocks, plants, and fish. Window borders of plants also surrounded the centerpiece of wild game, fish, and choice cuts of meat to tempt walkers-by. Jacobs also participated in another foot race during the Fireman's Parade in June, but no mention was made of the clothing. He also lost the race to none other than Johnny Behan. While Jacobs was wildly successful, he left the Grand at the end of 1882. He got married in 1883, moved to Prescott, Arizona, and then Denver, Colorado. He came back to Tombstone, where he ran another chop house in 1885, and by 1891, he was running the new Maison Dorée. Try your hand at this historic recipe, and remember, clothing is always a good idea when cooking. Roast quail. 6 quail. Butter, softened. 1 cup flour. 1/2 teaspoon salt. 1/4 teaspoon black pepper. Wash the quail inside and out and pat dry. Close the bird by tying the legs together. Rub butter over the birds and set aside. Combine flour, salt, and pepper in a shallow pan. Dredge the birds in flour to coat evenly. Placed in a roasting pan and bake uncovered at 350 degrees for 25 minutes or until done. Baste occasionally with the butter. This recipe was adapted from California's Sacramento Daily Record Union, March 5th, 1881. Sherry Monahan has penned Mrs. Earp, Wives and Lovers of the Earp Brothers, California Vines, Wines, and Pioneers, Taste of Tombstone, The Wicked West, and Tombstone's Treasure. She's appeared on the History Channel in Lost Worlds and other shows. Spark on the Prairie by Johnny D. Boggs. Hit the road across Oklahoma and Texas to discover the history behind the Warren Wagon Train Raid and the Kiowa Indian Trial of 1871. It started out as a run-of-the-mill job. Captain Henry Warren had a contract to deliver supplies to the forts on the Texas frontier, and in the spring of 1871, Warren and his teamsters left Mansfield, Texas, with five wagons loaded with cornmeal and flour. Mansfield had been a mill mecca since before the Civil War, when Ralph S. Mann and Julian Field built the Mann and Field Mill, the first in North Texas to use steam power. The town that grew up around it became Mansfield because people just weren't used to spelling F-E-I-L-D. Today, that mill heritage is showcased at the Mann House Museum and the Mansfield Historical Museum and Heritage Center. The wagons crossed the Trinity River at Fort Worth, Texas Civil War Museum, Log Cabin Village, and rolled into Weatherford, Doss Heritage and Culture Center, where Warren's crew joined seven other wagons. Now numbering 12 wagons and 12 men, the train reached Fort Richardson in Jacksboro and continued for Fort Griffin. What the teamsters had no way of knowing was that a party of Kiowa Indians waited up the trail at Salt Creek Prairie. Earlier on the reservation near present-day Lawton, Oklahoma, a prophet and medicine man named Maman T. had talked an estimated 150 Indians into following him on a raid. Among those joining the prophet were the bragging Satana, Young Big Tree, and embittered Satank, who spoke eloquently at the Medicine Lodge treaty negotiations in 1867, but now carried the bones of a son who had been killed in Texas in 1870. On May 17th, a military ambulance and mounted riders passed the Kiowas, but Maman T. said his vision forbade attacking. Had the prophet said otherwise, history might have been significantly altered, for in the ambulance rode William T. Sherman, bound for Fort Richardson. On the next afternoon, Warren's wagon train came into view and the Indians attacked. The Kiowas made off with 41 mules and six scalps. Seven teamsters had been killed, but one was bald. Wounded teamster Thomas Brazil and a colleague walked 20 miles through stormy weather to Fort Richardson. When Sherman heard Brazil's story, he ordered Colonel Ranald S. McKenzie in pursuit. Sherman, understanding how close he had come to death, traveled to Fort Sill, intent on bringing the Kiowa leaders to justice. While the military side of the story is well told at Fort Sill Historic Landmark, the fort remains an active base, the Lawton area is full of places to learn about the Southern Plains culture. Museum of the Great Plains, Comanche National Museum, and Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge. With help from Quaker Indian agent Larry Tatum and Colonel Benjamin Grierson's 10th Cavalry, Sherman arrested Satanta, Big Tree, and Satank after Satanta admitted to taking part in the raid. "These three Indians should never go forth again," Sherman wrote. Mamanti, who led the raid, was forgotten. McKenzie arrived at Fort Sill on June 4th, and 4 days later departed with the three prisoners. Satank, described by an Army and Navy Journal correspondent as a hoary-headed old sinner 60 years of age or thereabout, grown gray in iniquity and deeds of blood, covered himself with a blanket, began his death song, slipped free of his manacles, wounded a guard, and grabbed a carbine before being shot to death. On June 15th, Mackenzie's cavalrymen and the two remaining prisoners arrived at Jacksboro, where the trial, presided by Judge Charles Seward, began July 5th in a stifling second-story room at the courthouse. Samuel W.T. Lanham was lead prosecutor. Thomas Ball and Joseph A. Woolfolk were appointed as defense attorneys. Fort Sill's Horace Jones served as interpreter. Seward also allowed the defense motion to sever the trials, and Big Tree was tried first. The Dallas Herald reported that Ball's speeches were at some points most eloquent and displayed a thorough knowledge of the Indian character. When Ball asked the jury to let Satanta and Big Tree fly away as free and unhampered as an eagle, the defendants grunted and nodded at Jones's translation. Ball and Woolfolk called no witnesses for the defense. Lanham labeled Satanta as the archfiend of treachery and blood, and Big Tree a tiger demon who has tasted blood and loves it as his food. It took the jury 30 minutes to come back with a guilty verdict. Court was adjourned. In his trial the next day, Satanta testified on his own behalf, speaking in Comanche, interpreted by Jones. "If you let me live, I feel my ability to control my people," Satanta said. "If I die, it will be like a match put to the prairie. No power can stop it." It came as no surprise when the jury found him guilty, too. Both were sentenced to hang in Jacksboro on September 13th. But fearing the Kiowa match put to the prairie, Seward pleaded with Governor Edmund J. Davis to commute the sentences to life imprisonment. Davis agreed, and on October 16th, Satanta and Big Tree were transported to the state penitentiary in Huntsville, Texas Prison Museum. After Satanta and Big Tree were paroled in 1873, Sherman wrote Davis, "I believe Satanta and Big Tree will have their revenge, if they have not already had it, and that if they are to have scalps, that yours is the first that should be taken." Satanta took part in the Red River War of 1874-1875 and was returned to Huntsville, where his health faded. After being told in October 1878 that he had no chance of parole, he slashed himself and was taken to the second-story prison infirmary. Left alone, he committed suicide by jumping from the landing. Texas papers weren't sorry to learn of the suicide. Calling Satanta the Indian monster, the Galveston Daily News said Satanta was long a name on the plains to hate and abhor. Big Tree, however, worked on a supply train after his parole, helped establish the Rainy Mountain Indian Mission, and joined the church in 1897, serving as a deacon until his death in 1929. In 1963, Satanta's grandson asked Texas Governor John Connally for the Kiowa leader's bones to be returned home. It wasn't easy, but a resolution passed, and Satanta's remains were reburied with honors at Fort Sill. Satanta historian Charles Robinson wrote, "was going home at last." Virginia City, Montana, by Peter Corbett. The city struck it rich with a well-preserved ghost town. The Cartwrights and Bonanza made Virginia City, Nevada, famous. But the other Virginia city, the one in southwestern Montana, stakes a claim to its Bigfoot relevance in the history of the West. It was the site of one of the West's most lucrative placker gold strikes and served as Montana's territorial capital from 1865 to 1875. If you had climbed the hill behind Virginia City in 1864 and looked down the gulch, you would have seen a chaotic sight, wrote historian K. Ross Toole. 6,000 people, almost all young men, were digging, pushing, slushing, cursing, and fighting. Bill Fairweather, Henry Edgar, and four other prospectors started the stampede of prospectors to what became Virginia City after discovering placer gold in Alder Creek in May 1863. Virginia City and eight other rowdy mining camps were quickly established along a 14-mile stretch of the creek, and the population served to 8,000 or more. The easy gold was gone by the 1870s, and the towns dwindled over the next half century as the mines played out. An entire town was left behind. This is the largest collection of on-site, intact 1860s buildings in the entire West, local booster David Bacon said. Not just the buildings downtown, but the homes we live in as well. We're just part of that thread of stewardship of this town. It helped that Virginia City escaped the major fires that leveled many other western towns, said Bacon, a councilman, firefighter, and volunteer at the visitor center. Virginia City and neighboring Nevada City include about 275 historic structures now owned and protected by the state of Montana. Some are leased to private operators who keep the spirit of the West alive in the historic buildings. The Montana Heritage Commission also is a steward of close to a million artifacts from the 1860s to the mid-20th century. It's a unique little spot, Bacon said. To be in the same place, going through the same doorways, leaning against the same boards that people did almost 160 years ago, it's remarkable. I mean, literally, stepping back in time. It's kind of a cliche, but in this town, it's absolutely true. Much credit for preserving Virginia City and Nevada City goes to Charles and Sue Bovey. He was a rancher, state legislator, and his family owned a milling company that became General Mills. Starting in the 1940s, the Boveys bought abandoned buildings in both towns that locals were tearing down for firewood. They also acquired other historic buildings from around Montana and then moved them to Nevada City. The Boveys' son, Ford, sold the historic collection to the state in 1997 for $6.5 million. All the historic buildings in the two towns have been like gold fever to Western filmmakers. Scenes from Little Big Man, Missouri Breaks, and Return to Lonesome Dove were filmed in the area. Visitors to Virginia City will discover Rank's Mercantile, a general's store established in 1864 and touted as the oldest continuously operating store in the state. The H.S. Gilbert Brewery, the state's first. It's now a venue for Brewery Follies, with the troupe presenting a bawdy mix of music and comedy. Montana's oldest bar, the 150-year-old Bale of Hay Saloon. Saloon operator Skip Hissong said it was converted from a stable to a bar in 1867. These days, it hosts live music and serves some of Montana's best craft beers to thirsty tourists and Harley riders. The Gypsy Arcade in Virginia City includes a collection of arcade games, some at least a century old. Collectors have bid as high as $2 million to buy the arcade's extremely rare Gypsy Fortune Teller device. Overnight guests can stay at the 15-room Fairweather Inn or Bonanza Inn, which was a Sisters of Charity hospital. As with many historic hotels, ghost stories enchant and unnerve guests. The Fairweather's guestbook includes mentions of ghosts incidents, manager Patty Hamstra said. I've never seen a ghost, and I don't want to, she added. Peter Corbett moved west to Flagstaff in 1974 to attend Northern Arizona University, where he studied English and American studies. He's been exploring Arizona and the West since then and had a 35-year career in Arizona journalism. Pike Peaked by Bob Bowes Bell. Kid Curry versus Pike Landusky. Town's namesake laid low as the wildest of the wild bunch takes off. December 27, 1894. Celebrating the holidays in Jacob Jew Jake Harris's saloon in newly named Landusky, Montana, the town's namesake, Hal Pike Landusky is holding forth with his neighbors and friends at around 10:30 in the morning. Melting snow has clogged the store saloon stovepipe, and a young kid has been brought in to clean it out. Jew Jake hobbles around behind the bar on his one leg. The other was lost during a gunfight in Great Falls. He sets a bottle and glass on the bar in front of Landusky, who gets ready to take his first drink of the day. Stepping in out of the cold, Cowboys Loney Logan and Jim Thornhill, his neighboring rancher and partner, pass through the saloon into the clothing store. Their mission is to neutralize a gunman named Charles Hogan, a lunger. Thornhill orders 25 cents worth of apples as he and Loney take up positions to handle Hogan when the fireworks start. A few moments later, as planned, Harvey Logan, also known as Kid Curry, comes in the front door. Kid Curry's younger brother John stays outside and guards the front door with a Winchester. Kid Curry advances straight toward Landusky and aggressively slaps him on the shoulder, knocking the bottle out of his hand. When Landusky turns, Kid Curry punches the noted brawler in the face with all his might. When the two clinch, both Loney and Thornhill step forward, yelling out, "Fair fight!" Landusky's friends, including Hogan, are intimidated and hold back from joining in. As the men punch each other and scuffle, Kid Curry's pistol falls out of his coat pocket onto the floor. Thornhill fetches the Colt 45 by the barrel so no one can accuse him of assault. Landusky's friends later allege Thornhill waved it at bystanders, warning the first man that makes a move will be killed. Landusky is a grizzled, experienced brawler. He gets the advantage on Kid Curry, landing on top of the smaller man while trying to gouge out his eyes. Kid Curry manages to get on top, pummeling the much bigger man until Landusky cries out, "Enough!" A mining friend of Landusky, Thomas Carter, asks Loney to intercede, saying that Landusky has clearly had enough. Loney allegedly replies, "He has not had enough for what he has done to us." Thornhill finally convinces Kid Curry to let go of Landusky. The combatants stagger to their feet, and Landusky reaches in his coat and pulls out a semi-automatic pistol, an 1893 9mm Bouchard. As he does, he calls Kid Curry a coward for attacking him without cause. Landusky doesn't fire his pistol. One account claims he does, but either the gun misfired or he failed to chamber a round. Thornhill pitches the 45 to Kid Curry, who fires a shot in Landusky's gut. Curry fires three times in all, with two slugs hitting Landusky and one going awry. Landusky falls to the floor and dies in about 5 minutes. Brother John rounds up the cowboy's wagon, and the four make their escape. Another angle on the Pike fight. Hank Curry, Denver Henry Logan, was the stabilizer, the one who prevented an out-and-out war between his brothers and Pike Landusky. The oldest Curry brother often visited Landusky's home, apparently courting live-in schoolmarm Mary Everett. His brothers occasionally went with him, but there was always tension, especially when Loney started a forbidden relationship with Pike's stepdaughter, Elfie. The dam broke when Hank died of tuberculosis and pneumonia in late 1893. Without his guidance, his siblings went wild, drinking and carousing and hanging out with other hard cases. Landusky got more and more annoyed with the boys, and some near fights broke out. The broken plow incident and Pike's torture of the Currys while they were under arrest brought things to a boil. There were some peaceful times. The Landusky family and the Currys all attended Methodist church services held in Jake Harris's saloon. And Harvey, Loney, and Johnny were all heavily involved in putting on a community Christmas celebration on December 25th, 1894. But the peace on earth ended 2 days later when Kid Curry attacked and killed Pike Landusky. If Hank had been around, it might not have happened. Aftermath odds and ends. On May 14, 1895, a jury found Loney Logan not guilty in the death of Pike Landusky. More than 2 months later, a bench warrant was issued and served on Jim Thornhill. His case was dismissed without trial on December 2nd. Harvey Kid Curry Logan, having long fled the country, was never tried for Landusky's murder. Harvey soon joined George Flatnose Curry's outlaw band, later merging with Butch Cassidy's so-called Wild Bunch. A string of rustling and train robberies followed. Harvey was finally captured in 1901, but he escaped jail in Knoxville, Tennessee. After another train robbery near Parachute, Colorado, on June 7, 1904, lawmen surrounded the outlaw, and he killed himself rather than be recaptured. Loney apparently joined his brother at the Wild Bunch hangout, the Hole in the Wall, near the KC Ranch in Wyoming, and may have participated in the Wilcox, Wyoming train robbery in 1899. In February 1900, Loney returned to Dodson, Missouri to visit an aunt who had raised him. A posse trapped and killed him there. Jim Thornhill eventually sold his property in Landusky, Montana, and moved to Globe, Arizona in 1916. He died there in the late 1920s. Arrows, Pointed Death, by Phil Spangenberger. The Indian's ammunition grew on trees. An arrow, the deadly projectile propelled from a bow, could arguably be called the Indian's bullet. However, unlike the short lead round ball or conical slug fired by a gun, the arrow is a long, stiff, straight shaft with a weighty, sharpened, or blunt arrowhead attached to the front end. On the rear are multiple fin-shaped stabilizers, called fletchings, mounted along the sides, and a slot, known as the nock, at the back end for attaching the bowstring. While the firearm's bullets are only a few hundred years old, arrows predate recorded history by an estimated 64,000 years. Although historians debate just when this primitive weapon made its first appearance in North America, it's generally believed to have started spreading from Alaska downward through North America somewhere around 2000 BC. Since that time, the bow and arrow reigned as the primary arm the indigenous peoples of our continent relied on for both sustenance and warfare. From the first encounter with Europeans up through the mid-19th century and the introduction of repeating firearms, the Indian bow and arrows were often superior to the slow-loading, single- or two-shot muzzle-loading guns employed by the white man. On the frontier, lead, gunpowder, percussion caps, or metallic cartridges could often be difficult to obtain, while the bow's arrows literally grew on trees and were easy to produce in quantity. The bow, with its arrows, offered rapid fire, reliability, and in capable hands, close-range accuracy equal to that of the early firearms. As Josiah Gregg, a veteran of many months living in the Southwest, recalled of Native American weaponry in the 1830s and 1840s, the arms of the wild Indians are chiefly the bow and arrows, with the use of which they became remarkably expert. While the musketeer will load and fire once, the bowman will discharge a dozen arrows, and that, at distances under 50 yards, with an accuracy nearly almost equal to the rifle. As further testimony to the Indian archer's speed and accuracy, an army surgeon serving in the Southwest in 1862 noted that an expert bowman can easily discharge 6 arrows per minute, and a man wounded with one is almost sure to receive several arrows. We have not seen more than 1 or 2 men wounded by a single arrow only. To replenish his arsenal of arrows, an Indian could produce shafts from almost any type of local wood. Once a shaft was hand-straightened by heating over a fire, feathers of native birds were used for fletching. The feathers were tied to the shaft with animal sinew and possibly glued with a sticky substance made from animal products. Arrowheads, or points, could run from blunt-edged affairs, for stunning small game animals without harming the valuable meat, to simple sharp-pointed shafts. For a more deadly effect, hand-napped flint stone or iron points also attached by wrapped animal sinew would be used. Iron arrowheads could be crafted from wagon wheel tires, barrel hoops, or commercially produced heads acquired in trade with white settlers. Although there was no standardized length, arrows of the Plains Indians reportedly averaged around 22 to 24 inches in length. Southwestern tribes tended to run about 26 to 28 inches long, although there were some running as much as 30 inches or longer. Extra arrows were stored in soft quivers, usually made from elk, deer, buffalo, or puma hides, and were either left plain or, in many cases, decorated with trinkets and extra trappings, like flint and iron, strike-a-lights, extra sinew, spare metal arrow points, and other useful items carried in small bags called fire bags. As a testament to the combat effectiveness, along with the high respect of the Indians' primitive bow and arrows, one frontiersman wrote, "It was to us a much more terrific weapon of war than a musket." Phil Spangenberger has written for Guns and Ammo, appears on the History Channel and other documentary networks, produces Wild West shows, is a Hollywood gun coach and character actor, and is True West's firearms editor. Frontier Privies and Cowboy Cooks by Marcia Trimble. Question: what authority did Sheriff John Behan have to arrest Virgil Earp, who was the town marshal? J. Martin Tiengens, Liberty, Missouri. A county sheriff is the top political officer in the county. In other words, he outranks any lawman in the county. A deputy U.S. marshal has no authority over territorial marshal. His authority is to enforce federal law, and in this case, no federal law was broken. Behan did not arrest Virgil Earp. He did arrest Wyatt and Doc Holliday after Ike Clanton filed murder charges connected to the street fight near the OK Corral. After the Spicer hearings cleared the Earps and Holliday, Virgil returned to his job as town marshal. He remained town marshal and deputy U.S. marshal until he was badly wounded in an assassination attempt by the Clanton Leg Cowboy Gang on December 28, 1881. What were the American Indians called by Europeans in the late 19th century? Tim Simons, East Sussex, United Kingdoms. In the past, they were referred to as pagans. Sometimes they were called savages, Indians, or by their tribal names, which is how they prefer to be called today. Of all the generals who fought during the Civil War, who would you consider the best? Zack Wheat, St. Louis, Missouri. There were quite a number of good generals on both sides, but if I had to pick one, it would be Nathan Bedford Forrest. Where was the chuck wagon located during long trail drives? Bud Hack, East St. Paul, Minnesota. The chuck wagon didn't travel with the herd. The cook would have to move on up the trail at a fast clip, so chow would be ready for the midday meal. It took almost 2 hours to get food ready, and the cowhands wouldn't tolerate late meals. After the cowhands were fed breakfast, the cook would clean up the plates, pots, and pans, and then move on ahead to prepare dinner before the herd arrived at the noon stop. Would a cowboy ever use a lariat as a noose, or would he bring a separate rope, say for hanging a horse thief or a rustler? Jeff Bishop, Troy, Missouri. That is a very good question because it brings up an important point. Contrary to popular myth, stealing a horse has never been a capital offense in any state or territory. Lynching horse thieves did occur, but not that frequently. If a man was being lynched, the hangmen were probably amateurs. They'd sit the doomed man on a horse, drop a loop around his neck, throw their lariat over a stout tree limb, and anchor it to the trunk. Then they slap the horse in the rump, leaving the man dangling and dying slowly. It was crude, and it wasn't pretty. A trained hangman would use a good, sturdy rope, usually oiled and stretched, for public hangings. From that, he built a noose, placed it snugly around the neck, and put the knot securely behind the left ear. He adjusted the length of the rope to conform with the man's weight, so that when the trap was sprung, the drop was enough to break the neck. Instant death occurred if everything was done right. A good hangman took great pride in his work. I read in True West that the use of toilet paper was uncommon in the Wild West days. What did people do to clean themselves? Gisela Gigi Ripple, Kingman, Arizona. They used dirt, leaves, grass, sticks, corn cobs, that sort of thing. If an old newspaper was near, that would suffice. They might wash themselves in a stream if one was near. But hygiene was not a big concern back then, so body odor was a problem. Marshall Trimble is Arizona's official historian and vice president of the Wild West History Association. His latest book is Arizona Oddities, Land of Anomalies and Tamales, History Press, 2018. If you have a question, write Ask the Marshal, P.O. Box 8008, Cave Creek, Arizona, 85327, or email him at marshall.trimble@scottsdalecc.edu. Please always include your name, city, and state.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.